watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And
this you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. A while ago, in response to a previous show, a listener wrote to take exception to my characterization of the current anti-immigrant hysteria as based on racism and xenophobia. While the issue is more complex than that, it seems to be the primary motive for groups like the so-called Minutemen, the armed vigilantes who are prowling the borders in California and Arizona. I say this not from conjecture, but from experience, having had the misfortune to grow up as a child of immigrants in a miserable exurb between Los Angeles and San Diego, populated by vicious and narrow-minded right-wingers, ignorant of other cultures, and damn proud of it. But then, as our previous readings from John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education have shown, America, the nation of immigrants, has always greeted its immigrants with hostility. And the same slanders now directed at current immigrants, stupidity, criminality, disease carriers, and destroyers of the nation, were once directed at preceding waves of immigrants, including the Irish, Italians, and Polish, all of them duly authorized to enter so they could be put to work at slave wages, in slave conditions then as now. It's particularly ironic that the states where the Minutemen now patrol the borders were taken from Mexico in a trumped-up war whose goal was to expand slavery to Texas. That said, a large population of undocumented migrants poses a problem to those already living on the edge in places like California, where affordable housing is non-existent. Many of the migrants by necessity lived crammed by the dozen into the area's overpriced rentals, putting downward pressure on the living standards of people in an increasingly low-wage economy. Because of their status, they must accept substandard wages and conditions without recourse, undermining the efforts of those on the butt end of the economy to organize for better conditions. But those who blame the migrants are missing the point, as our first speaker on the program this week, Miguel de la Rosa, will explain. He spoke at Ithaca College a few weeks ago as part of a speaking tour arranged by the human rights group Witness for Peace. Ben Beachy, an organizer with Witness, will introduce the program, beginning with the history of his organization, founded during the 1980s to educate Americans on the actual effects of U.S. policies in Latin America.
The way we got our start was basically a bunch of folks in the United States, like yourselves, reading the newspapers. And they were reading, and they saw that on one side of the newspaper, they saw reports from Ronald Reagan, who had a few things to say about the Contras, beyond the fact that we were giving them money. One of the things that Ronald Reagan had to say about the Contras was, you know, these guys are freedom fighters. You might remember he compared them to our founding fathers. These were the Thomas Jeffersons, the Benjamin Franklins of our era. On the other side of the paper, you could look and you'd see a report from Amnesty International. Contras go in, massacre a village, target civilians, display the bodies in front of the village. Another community is attacked using terrorist tactics, where the Contras are using terrorist tactics. This is something that a lot of people in the United States couldn't just sit with this. a lot of people in the United States couldn't just see this great contradiction between what our government was doing and saying and what they were hearing from other independent sources in Nicaragua. So a lot of people decided that, well, we should go check this out. So they went to Nicaragua. They went down on the first delegation. What that meant basically was going around talking to people, asking what are your lives like? What does it mean to live under the Contra War? What does it mean on a daily basis? One time while they were going through the country up north and near Jalapa, this is an area near Honduras, they were passing alongside a tobacco cooperative. And as they were passing by, they saw smoke rising from the cooperative. They knew something was up, and so they turned into the cooperative and they started talking to the people. And the people were running around. They were screaming. They were yelling and obviously in a panic because the Contra had just attacked. They started sitting down with a number of the members of the community and they started telling them very openly what their lives were like. They told them what it meant to not know the next moment at which you might be attacked. They told them what it meant to have already lost their own family members to this war. They were talking for a while, and while they were talking, they started hearing mortars coming from the Nicaraguan and Honduran border. And people started screaming again. The Contra were attacking again while they were there. And so they had a decision to make. Do you stay or do you go? The people in the community said, you can't leave us. We were just telling you, we were just talking to you about what this means, what our lives are like, how your government's involved in this, and how hard it is. And if you stay here, maybe they won't attack us. They'll see you. They know where their money comes from. It comes from you. They'll know that. They won't attack us. Stay here. You got to help us out. And a lot of them were considering this when the bus driver piped in. The bus driver said to them, now, if the Contras are coming to attack you and you've got a way out, you get out. I've got a bus, and I'm taking it. You guys can decide. What do you do? This group left. They left that community. They heard the mortars still coming as they left. They weren't content to just let it go with that. They decided when they got back together in Managua and they reassembled that this could not be the end. This had to be the beginning. And so that was the beginning of Witness for Peace. They went back to the United States and they got together 100 people to go back with them to Nicaragua on a second delegation. They went back then thereafter and organized dozens and dozens and dozens of delegations that went to Nicaragua throughout the 80s to see firsthand what was happening at the behest of our government's policies. In 1990, well, and eventually the end result of that was we stopped then funding for the Contras. It became illegal. They had to go through an Iran-Contra scandal to get money for the Contras. Then in 1990, the war ended, and we're left wondering, what do we do? Once again, should we stay or should we go? And so this time, once again, we asked our community contacts, what should we do? And they told us, one man put it really precisely, he said, listen, although people are not dying of bullets anymore, they're still dying of hunger, and your government still has a lot to do with that. You should stay. So we stayed, and we started focusing on economic policies. And that's what we've been doing ever since, not just in Nicaragua. We opened up units in Mexico, where Todd works and where Miguel lives. We opened up a unit in Colombia, focusing on the militarization there. Opened up a unit in Cuba, in Guatemala, and we've also taken delegations to Haiti, to Venezuela, and to Bolivia. So our focus has become much larger than what it was, but still with the lens always of U.S. policy. What is the United States doing in Latin America? What really are the roots behind these crises we've seen in Latin America? So today, we have a new crisis that we're looking at, and that's why Miguel's here. We see migration. We are all now in the United States. We open up our newspapers, we look on one side, and you see on one hand, migration trends increasing. More and more people coming across the border, more and more people crossing illegally into the United States. On the other hand, you see that it's becoming harder and harder to be a migrant in the United States of America. Someone at a recent, when we just did one of these talks recently, someone told me that on that morning on a talk show, he had heard one of the talk show hosts linking the current staph virus. You guys heard of the staph virus that's killing some people? The staph virus, linking that with dirty, illegal immigrants that are bringing that into our country. This is the mentality that's being spread often in our country now about migration. So if it's getting harder to become a migrant in the United States, and yet more and more people are doing it, we once again have to shrug. Say, why is that? Once again, we have to go investigate what's really going on in Mexico. Miguel comes to us from a state in Mexico named Oaxaca that has seen many of its people lost to migration. It's a state that has seen a lot of conflict in the last year. Most of you have probably read the headlines in the last year. And the conflict that flared up killed 23 people, one of them a New Yorker named Brad Will, photojournalist. So Miguel comes to us from this conflict. We continue as Witness for Peace to try to bring people to the scene of the where the policies are most dramatically felt, where they're not theory but actual daily reality. And when you can't go to Latin America, we're bringing people like Miguel here so that he, as a first-hand expert, can share with you. So Todd and Miguel are going to now share with us their first-hand knowledge.
Hi, I'm Todd Miller. I work with Witness for Peace in Mexico. I've been there for about 2 years. Witness for Peace has been in Mexico. The program has been there for about 10 years. For about six of those years, we've had a relationship with EDUCA, which is Miguel's organization. EDUCA is the Spanish initials for Services for an Alternative Education. They do community development projects and community organizing, especially in indigenous communities in rural Oaxaca. This sort of organizing had led them into the middle of the social conflict that exploded in Oaxaca last year. They were one of the principal organizations in the civil society branch of the social movement. There were ramifications for EDUCA. They suffered threats. People threatened to come and burn down their office. They had to actually work in exile for a month, and the director had to go. The director had to go into hiding. It's obvious, but the work of EDUCA has inspired us with Witness for Peace for many, many years, and it's an honor for me to be accompanying Miguel on this speaking tour and to be here in Ithaca tonight. So.
Buenas noches, mi nombre es Miguel Ángel Vázquez de la Rosa. Yo vengo del estado de Oaxaca, estado que se ubica al sur de México.
Good evening, my name is Miguel Ángel Vázquez de la Rosa. I come from the state of Oaxaca, and this state is located in the south of Mexico.
Durante cinco semanas haremos una gira con
Witness for 5 weeks. We're with Witness for Peace. We're doing a speaking tour and going to many cities and towns throughout the United States. And what we're doing is trying to spread the word about the complex problems that are happening in my country. But besides that, we are trying to establish a relationship between the problem that's going on in my country and what's going on in the United States. The presentation that we're doing on this speaking tour is called The Political Crisis in Oaxaca and the Deep Roots of Migration. But before beginning the presentation, I would like to give some reasons. Why am I here? Why am I here in the United States? And why am I going to talk about my country? I want to share with you that Mexico and the United States shares a common border that is 3,200 kilometers long. And Mexico also has commercial relationships with the United States, especially after signing a free trade agreement, the NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, in the year of 1994. And if this wasn't enough, the United States is the principal destination of a huge quantity of Mexicans who are migrating to this country. And according to conservative estimates, there lives 12 million Mexicans in this country. And that's why we can't be apart from a problem that both of our countries are involved with. So before it was said that when the United States caught a cold, then Mexico would get pneumonia. And now we can say when the United States gets a cold, and Mexico also gets a cold. So it's important to be able to talk about all these complex problems, migration, poverty, authoritarianism, and relate these problems between the two countries.
Por ello ahora empezamos.
And that's from there, this is where we'll begin tonight.
Para explicar la situación
en to be able to explain my state, we always start the presentation with a photograph, and a photograph to better understand Oaxaca. In this photo, you see Mixtecos, and they're from the coastal region of Oaxaca, from the municipality of Santiago Ixtayutla. And this is one of the most impoverished municipalities in all of Mexico.
Si hay una foto.
If there has ever been a photo that would be able to explain the contradictions in my country, the contradictions between wealth and poverty, it's all here in this photo. Oaxaca is a very wealthy place culturally. It has 16 different indigenous peoples, and it has a settlement of Afro-Mestizos that are on the coast. Oaxaca, in cultural terms, in terms of the environment, in terms of biodiversity, Oaxaca becomes one of the richest states in all of Mexico. But paradoxically, with all of this cultural, natural wealth, we also have so much poverty.
Pero veamos un poco más qué es Oaxaca.
But let's see a little bit more about what Oaxaca is.
Oaxaca
is located in the south of Mexico, and it borders with the states of Chiapas, Veracruz, Puebla, and Guerrero.
Se dice que
Oaxaca is considered to be the indigenous soul of the country, and this is because of its deep and rich history. Oaxaca, in fact, the place of Oaxaca has almost more deep and rich history than any other place in Mexico. And I was talking about the incredible diversity that my state has. In Oaxaca, 16 different indigenous languages are spoken, and the variants are the dialects of these languages. In terms of surface area of the state, it's about 95,000 square kilometers. That makes Oaxaca the fifth largest state in the 32 states that make up Mexico. And to be able to explain a little bit more the diversity in Oaxaca and how it's organized, there are 570 municipalities, which are like counties, and over 10,000 communities. And as we can appreciate in the map, there are eight different regions in Oaxaca, and this brings the diversity. We have jungles, we have forests, we have a huge coast.
Y entonces muchos nos preguntaremos por qué entonces un estado con una.
And then we can ask ourselves why a place with such natural, environmental, cultural wealth, why would such a place have so much poverty? And so we could say that the contradictions that we see in Oaxaca are the contradictions that we're seeing on a worldwide level. The process of globalization that began two decades ago, the results have not been realized. Some months ago, there was a meeting between some of the heads of state in Davos, Switzerland, and they came to the conclusion that globalization was generating a worldwide disenchantment. And this conclusion came from the results of globalization. There was a deepening poverty, or more poverty in the world. There were increasing authoritarian governments. And for other sides, on the other hand, also there is increasing social exclusion. And so what we're talking about when we talk about exclusion, we're talking about exclusion to the ultimate extreme. In Brazil, they talk about them, about the extra masses. Or in Argentina, they're considered the economically displaced. And then, on the other hand, something that we're facing right now is that the democratic processes are more and more lacking substance. It seems like as the democratic processes increase, also poverty is increasing right alongside it. A few years ago, there was a study made in Latin America, and they asked two basic questions in the study. One of the questions was like, are you in agreement with democracies in Latin America, or do you think it's a good idea? And the majority said, yeah, we're definitely in agreement that there's democracy. But the other question was, do you think that democracy is resolving the issue of poverty in our countries?
Y en su mayoría la respuesta era que no.
But the majority of people said no to that question. But not everything is a crisis in the world. Right now we're seeing a series of changes, very important changes in the world. And all of the insatisfaction that you're seeing in many sectors around the world, this is translating itself into social movements and more citizen participation. And more and more, a new type of citizenship is emerging, this global citizenship or world citizenship.
esta ciudadanía.
And this new global citizenship is concerned with problems that affect us all, that where we have common interests. And it seems like there is a global citizens, a community of global citizens forming.
Al parecer también,
and we're also, it seems like we're seeing a new political map, a new correlation of forces in the political map of the world.
Ya no solamente
not only is there the power of the United States, there is power countries in the global south that are organizing themselves. And one example of this is the alliance that you have between Brazil, South Africa, and India.
Entonces, en el mundo están pasando.
So in the world, there are many important things, interesting things happening. But what's happening in Mexico? In Mexico in the year 2000, it seemed like that we were beginning a democratic process, a democratic change. After being governed by one party for 70 years, it seemed like in 2000 that we were starting this democratic transition. With the arrival of President Vicente Fox in 2000, it really raised hopes among the people that through this change, this political change, that really a profound democratic change would result. But what happened in these 6 years, what we had with Vicente Fox, is that we had a decomposition of the political regime. And maybe the image that best expresses this is what we see right behind us. During the inauguration of President Felipe Calderón, he did it in the midst of a series of protests. These protests were very suspicious that a fraud had taken place in the elections of 2006. But surely, right now, Vicente Fox has his own speaking tour in the United States, and he's promoting his new book. In his new book, he says, "Oh, Mexico, you know, it's reached democracy. It has democracy, and the reason why is because him." Vicente Fox, who was just a simple Coca-Cola distributor, a driver of a truck, became president of Mexico.
Imagínense.
So in other words, Mexico has the type of democracy that any driver or any Coca-Cola salesman could arrive to be the president of Mexico.
Lo preocupante es que dejó.
And the worrisome thing about this is that the power in Mexico has been left into the sector of the extreme right. And this is best expressed by the president, Felipe Calderón, who is not only very conservative, he's also a very militaristic president.
Lo preocupante
and, the mo- and it's worrisome that the principal problems in Mexico are poverty and inequality and in front of all these problems, the president of Mexico is investing more of the public resources in the armed forces and in the military. And this story might sound really familiar to you, but this is the president that when he arrived, he invented a war against drug trafficking.
Entonces se planteó como tres asuntos prioritarios en su agenda de gobierno.
So he proposed three basic priorities in the governmental agenda.
El primer tema.
So the first was national security, investing in armed forces, in the military, in the police.
Segundo tema.
The second is foreign direct investment, and that's to say opening the doors of the country so this sort of investment comes in. And the third thing is structural reform, and this structural reform is modifying the laws in Mexico, such as legislation around labor legislation or energy legislation, to be able to facilitate increased foreign direct investment into Mexico.
Y como cuarto tema de interés, bueno, los programas sociales para combatir la pobreza.
And the fourth priority for the government, well, you know, it's social programs to help the poor.
Entonces vemos en
if you look at the photograph, we have a photograph of two Mexicos. One Mexico is a government, a president that is investing the majority of the public budget into armed forces. And on the below, you see Mexico that is submerged in poverty.
Con esta información,
with all this information, I want to be able to relate the economic and political situations in the country and on a global level with the crisis that happened last year.
Si
so
es
if it's true, if there's a global crisis, only if it's true, Oaxaca can be an image of the global crisis. And in the image, we're seeing the historic center of Oaxaca, and we're seeing a demonstration of teachers, unions, that are being repressed by the police. And these events happened last year, and it expresses a people that we're completely fed up with, that we're sick of, and we're just completely discontent with their government.
Algunas razones para explicar este descontento.
And some reasons to be able to explain this discontent.
In 2004,
the United Nations Program for Development did a study, and they concluded in the study that Oaxaca was the second poorest state in Mexico behind Chiapas. And the World Bank which gives loans to many Latin American countries, they did a study, and they concluded in their study that out of every 100 Oaxacans, 76 live in poverty or extreme poverty. Being that Oaxaca is a state that's eminently rural, meaning that the population lives off their farms, that there are many, many small farmers, the state government only destines 2.9% of its public budget to the small farmers in the countryside. In this situation, amongst many different situations, make the small farmers in Oaxaca who have no other alternative, they then sell their lands and migrate to other places.
La oficina del migrante en Oaxaca mencionó que
the Office on Migration in Oaxaca mentions that 150,000 Oaxacans migrate every year, either to the north of the country or to the United States of America. There are different types of migration. There's one is a temporary migration where people go and then they come back. And then there's an indefinite migration where people might go and never come back and stay permanently. And Oaxaca is a state that's really, really has a lot of tourism. So a pillar of the Oaxacan economy is the tourists, the money that tourism brings. And another pillar of the Oaxacan economy is coffee. A great number of Oaxacan families, they work in the production of coffee. And the third pillar of wealth, or the source of income for the Oaxacan economy, are the remittances, or the money that Oaxacans send back from the United States. Oaxacans that are living and working in the southern United States or in other states in the U.S., and another factor that has greatly increased poverty are the impacts, what we would call the impacts of free trade. And this agreement that was signed in 1994 really expressed the idea that our country, Mexico, was now part of the first world. And we know that this agreement was signed under unfavorable conditions, not on a level playing field. For example, the production of a small farmer in Oaxaca certainly isn't the same as a huge producer in the U.S., like in the state of California, for example. And the subsidies to the small farmers keep on being reduced. And the idea of the government to solve this problem is to install maquiladoras, or assembly plants, in a sense turning the farm workers into industrial workers. In Oaxaca and other places, in rural places around Mexico, we've had to suffer the effects of the falling of the price of corn. And then not too long ago as well, this year actually, a crisis around corn erupted in Mexico as corn prices skyrocketed, and then also the price of tortilla, which is the national food of Mexico, also skyrocketed. And what we have in the south of Mexico is a plan that's been installed by the government, and it's called the Plan Puebla Panamá.
Es un plan que abarca 9 estados del sur de México y todo Centroamérica.
And this is a plan that takes on 9 states in the south of Mexico and all of Central America.
La idea es
And the idea behind this project is to create a corridor, a commercial and industrial corridor, and also it's also promoting development projects, such as development projects around electricity. The problem with this is the majority of these macro projects that are going on are going to be done in indigenous places where there are a lot of natural resources. And I want to say that all of this has a complexity, a very serious complexity, and I want to be able to relate all these problems that we've talked up to this point to the crisis that happened in Oaxaca last year. I want to say that last year, in 2006, a crisis, a political crisis, exploded in Oaxaca. It's a crisis that we had never seen before. And what unleashed the conflict was a repression of the government against a demonstration, or better said, a peaceful teacher strike. And after this repression, that's when the conflict really was unleashed. As reasons behind this were the violations of human rights from the government of Oaxaca, Ulises Ruiz Ortiz, the constant violation of human rights. Violations of freedom of expression. For example, the first thing that the governor did in Oaxaca was close down a newspaper.
Pero también los constantes conflictos agrarios políticos suscitados en el estado.
But also the constant conflicts, agrarian political conflicts that you see throughout the state.
Ante ello,
and with all this, with this sort of pretext, the people got together in Oaxaca and they organized themselves into a citizens' movement, a very interesting citizens' movement, which is called the Popular Assembly of the Peoples of Oaxaca, or the APO. So in Oaxaca, in 6 months, there was a popular uprising, and the people organized themselves in a very, very interesting way under this umbrella of the APO. The movement brought together indigenous movements, teachers, non-governmental organizations, women, people that came from neighborhoods, students. This movement has two principal demands. The first demand is the resignation of the governor, Ulises Ruiz Ortiz, and they want to go through the legal means. The second is profound changes in the political and economic situation in Oaxaca. On the 27th of October of last year, in the very heat of the crisis, The indie media journalist Brad Will is assassinated, and the government uses this pretext of the assassination of Brad Will to then bring in federal forces and repress and have an escalation of forces against the people and the popular movement.
El movimiento realmente desafió a los poderes constituidos.
So really, the movement really challenged the political powers in Mexico. It really challenged it, and that's why the government came in with probably the most ferocious repression that's ever been done against the social movement in Oaxaca.
En estos seis meses se documentó la muerte de 23 personas.
In these 6 months, 23 people were killed, and all due to the conflict. 350 people were detained illegally. It was documented harassment against activists and human rights defenders.
Quiero explicar muy brevemente estas dos fotografías que son muy impactantes.
I want to explain really briefly these two photographs that are very that have a lot of impact. So in the photograph on the left hand side, he's lying on a cement thing. Is the mechanic, and his name is Jose Jimenez Colmenares.
Jose
Jimenez Colmenares accompanied his wife, who's a teacher, to the demonstrations and the marches. But there was the craziness of the governor, who had came up with what was called the Iron Plan, and one of the ideas behind the Iron Plan is to have paramilitary groups shoot in to these peaceful demonstrations or marches. And in the other photograph, it's an architect. And the architect went out, and he had a roll of his plans, and the architectural plans, and he was going to make copies. But the police saw that and they thought it was a bazooka. And because they thought it was a bazooka, they detained him and beat him savagely.
¿Cuál era el mensaje del gobierno? ¿Cuál era el mensaje que estaba enviando?
What was the message that the government was sending with this?
Es sembrar terror en la población común, haya o no haya participado dentro del movimiento.
It's planting terror in the population, whether they participated or not in the movement.
Por eso nosotros afirmamos.
And this is why we say that the government seemed like they were using a counterinsurgency manual to repress a peaceful movement.
Pero además,
but in the media, they were spreading the word that the APO was an urban guerrilla movement.
Nada más alejado que la realidad. Los muertos y los heridos siempre fueron del lado del movimiento.
But nothing could be further from the truth because all the deaths and all the people that were injured were always part of the movement. And you might be asking yourself, what happened in Oaxaca? Was there justice? Was there not justice? Is the governor still in power? Is he not? In the island of impunity, which is my country and my state of Oaxaca, the governor, nothing happened. The governor still governs. Nevertheless, the pressure, the national pressure within Mexico, international pressure, right now the governor is facing some judicial processes. In the Attorney General's office in Mexico, there is an accusation or a case of torture and forced disappearances against the governor. The House of Representatives in Mexico is currently doing a political trial, and the Supreme Court of Mexico is doing an investigation about human rights violations. And also on an international level, organizations such as Amnesty International or the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, which is a part of the Organization of American States, have made recommendations to my government and my country so that there is justice done in the case of Oaxaca. And with all this information, we could have a more of a complete panorama that's happening in my country and in my state. Because when you look at the media, what the media is saying, it's only talking in half-truths.
Con esta información, la idea
and to conclude, I want to mention, what is the spiritual force that has sustained the people of Oaxaca, the people of Oaxaca that have suffered so many violations of their human rights, so much social damage to them, so much humiliation by their government?
Esta fuerza espiritual se basa en la tradición y en la fuerza identitaria que existe en los pueblos y comunidades de Oaxaca.
And this spiritual force, it's based in the traditions and the force of the identity of the peoples of Oaxaca.
Quiero explicarles estas dos fotografías que tenemos.
I want to explain these two photographs that we have here.
On
the left-hand side, we have a woman that's a triqui, and she is doing a ritual to the Mother Earth. And during the conflict, many people did rituals like this to ask for peace and justice in the conflict of Oaxaca.
La relación de los pueblos indígenas en Oaxaca, y en muchos lugares, es muy cercana con la tierra, con la madre tierra.
And the relationship between indigenous peoples in Oaxaca and many other places is very, very close to the land or the earth or Mother Earth.
Eso mantiene y fortalece la resistencia de los pueblos en Oaxaca.
And this maintains and it sustains the resistance of the peoples in Oaxaca.
Del lado derecho quiero explicarles esta fotografía que podía ser algo muy irreverente en otros contextos.
And on the right-hand side, I want to show you this photograph that could be something irreverent in other places.
En algunas colonias de Oaxaca,
and in many of neighborhoods in Oaxaca, under the imminent threat of the entrance of the armed forces in Oaxaca, many people went out into the streets and installed barricades. In many of the popular neighborhoods in Oaxaca, they began to install this image, which is called the Holy Virgin of the Barricades.
As you know,
the Virgin of Guadalupe is very important in Mexico. And in Oaxaca, it's the Virgin of the Soledad.
Esta imagen,
this image takes on many of the sacred symbols, but it's also adapted to the conflicts or the context of the conflict in Oaxaca.
Vemos que la imagen,
and you can see on her face that she has a gas mask on, an anti-tear gas mask, which many people would use to prevent the tear gas from coming into them when the police were shooting tear gas at people during the repression.
Y en su manto,
and on her shawl, you can see that there are burning tires, and many people put these burning tires in the barricades, especially at night.
¿Qué quiero decirles con esto?
What do I want to say with all this?
Que parte de la
lucha, part of the struggle in Oaxaca is a struggle of symbols. It's a struggle to be able to recuperate the symbols.
En este caso, los símbolos religiosos también puestos en juego durante el conflicto.
And in this case, the religious symbols were also under risk during the conflict.
Y ahora yo creo que la mayor,
and I also want to say that the struggles of our people, they are very symbolic.
Finalmente,
finally, what is the message that I want to leave with you today? And you might be wondering, what is this Oaxacan doing here in my country, talking about my country here? I want to say that Oaxaca is a metaphor. It's something that could happen in any place in the world.
En cualquier lugar del mundo donde haya pobreza,
it could happen in any place where there's structural poverty, structural injustice, official violence, or any sort of authoritarian governmental system.
En donde pase eso, estamos viendo como una fotografía del conflicto en Oaxaca.
In all of this, we are seeing a photograph of the conflict in Oaxaca.
Lo que
And what is required as global citizens, as people of the world that are concerned about what's happening in many places in the world, is that we need to reconstruct the weavings or the social fabric of places that have been damaged by crisis.
Esto lo podemos reconstruir a través de la solidaridad entre los países.
And this is what we can reconstruct by solidarity and solidarity between countries.
Se ha dicho que la solidaridad es la ternura de los pueblos y yo creo que a eso estamos llamados los países del mundo.
And they have said that solidarity is the gentleness and the kindness between peoples, and this is what we're called to in the world.
Pues esta era la información.
This is the presentation that I brought, and I thank you all for being here and listening to this presentation.
Si hubiera alguna pregunta,
The situation with the people from Oaxaca now seeking redress in the legislature.
In the legislature.
And the Supreme Court.
In the.
Seems paradoxical because.
What I see.
The same government to which one is applying for justice is the one that is believed to have stolen the election and occupy it without legitimacy. Speak to that more fully, Miguel, please.
Entonces, mi pregunta es que si puedes hablar un poquito más de eso, completar eso un poquito más.
In terms of the strategy of the people in Oaxaca.
Sí, es muy difícil de explicar, pero voy a tratar de dar una explicación.
It's very difficult to explain, but I'm going to try to give an explanation.
Siempre la lucha del pueblo de Oaxaca se planteó como una lucha legal.
So always the struggle in Oaxaca was presented as a legal struggle, a struggle that was peaceful, and a struggle that was looking for the legal means to be able to resolve their problems.
En la parte más
and during the heat of the conflict, in front of the Senate of the Republic, they brought forth what was called this a request or a case of which is called the dissolution of political powers.
Y fíjense lo que respondió.
So the Senate, responding to this, said, yes, there is ingovernability in Oaxaca. Yes, there's instability in Oaxaca. No, the government can't guarantee social peace. However, the laws in the country, because of the laws or the framework of laws in the country, they couldn't disappear or do the dissolution of political powers because the laws were not reacting to the new reality in Mexico.
Esa es parte de la realidad.
With, you know, with the institutions and laws in Mexico, they're obsolete. They're not. They're old. They just are not responding to the demands of the people. They're not responding to the people, and. but they are the laws or the institutions that we have. In fact, there's a saying in Mexico, and I'm not sure how to translate the saying very well. I don't know if somebody.
These old mules, we've got to use them.
Yeah, the old mules, we got to use them.
Entonces, aunque estas autoridades.
Yes, these authorities, these political authorities are, that we do suspect these people of fraud, or and especially at a federal level, but they're the institutions that we have. And so we're going to go by, this is who we have to use, and this is how we're going to have to go through, these are the people we have to go through to try to resolve our problems by legal means.
Sí.
In other words, none of the approaches like going to the Supreme Court, going to the legislators, is going to guarantee or that first that maybe the government can be removed or that the social problem is addressed.
Sí.
El problema está en las leyes.
Sí, básicamente nosotros.
So basically, a group of us, or my organization that I work for, a group of organizations, have gone together and well documented a lot of documentation, have initiated a political trial about the case of Oaxaca. But what we have are our laws, and the context of the laws, or the frameworks of the laws, or the legal means to do this. Are not working, and I don't think there will be able to force the resignation of the governor.
¿Qué si lo podría destituir?
But the only thing that could be able to force the resignation of the governor is a pact between the principal powers in the country. And we're talking about the two principal political powers, the PRI and the PAN, and also an alliance with the business sector. This, it's a bad example, you know, this, but... I mean, the laws, you know, aren't working in Mexico, and this is the only way that we could force him to resign.
Tenemos dos manos levantadas atrás y una adelante.
What kind of projects has the organization Educa taken about to create alliances and solidarity amongst the own community and indigenous neighboring communities?
Sí. Le doy un ejemplo.
I want to give an example of a project that Educa is doing to promote these sort of actions and weaving people together.
In
many poor municipalities, one of the projects is that we have a network of small projects, and this is called the network of communities, the network of economic communities, and it's called Geisha. ¿En cómo que quiere decir?
Zapoteco significa compartir.
And it means in the language Zapoteco to share.
Son
so these are projects that are credit, you know, and savings, like a credit institution or savings institution, a food bank where people can get corn cheaper, for example. Also, like projects around for people being more productive or using productive means. And this way, the communities can support each other mutually. So what Educa does is give trainings and to its leaders, and it also helps get funds for these projects, and this kind of generates what we call synergy. And this is a local example. The other example is that Educa has connections with like Witness for Peace, and Witness for Peace could be considered, you know, generating a process of trans-border solidarity. So Witness for Peace brings delegations, and the delegations don't come just to see the poor and say, oh, the poor in Oaxaca, you know, what's going on with the poor in Oaxaca? They come to see some of the projects that organizations are doing, how people are organizing together to overcome their problems.
What was and is the role or the non-role of the Catholic Church in the struggle?
Sí.
The Catholic Church had a role that was very important, we could even say central, in the struggle.
Solamente en dos expresiones.
In two expressions.
Una.
One is the people that were organized in base communities.
Que se vinculó
that connected directly with in the organizational process. They participated directly in an organized way, not only in the demonstrations, but also in forums of discussion to give more content to what people were discussing in the struggle.
Por otro lado,
on the other hand, on the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, you could say the bishops and some of the priests as well. And they tried to keep an aspect of neutrality to the conflict, that's to say they didn't really support any side. They wanted to be neutral. This is very unfortunate because what was happening with the conflict, there were serious injustices happening, and the church could have, asked for some sort of peaceful solution to that. So that part of it is.
Este fue el papel
and that was basically the role of the church.
About the teachers, why was it the teachers that were in the leadership and then of the struggle? And then did the struggle have an impact on the educational institutions at all?
In Oaxaca, there's 14,000 schools. And in these schools is where the teachers from the teachers union are teachers. Or they form a part of these schools. During the conflict, we went through about 4 months where these 14,000 schools were closed.
Esto quiere decir que durante este tiempo los niños no asistieron a la escuela.
And this means that during that time, the kids did not go to school.
Esto fue una de las.
So this really, really divided the public opinion in Oaxaca. On one side, there were people saying, this is really serious. The children are not going to school. On the other side, there were people saying, oh, this is how it is. This is a part of the social struggle, and this is how we construct history.
Definitivamente.
So definitely, this had an impact. The conflict had an impact on education. However, there's many ways to think about it. I am an optimist, and I'm hoping that this impact will. There is learning that can be done from this impact, especially pedagogically from this struggle, from the history of the struggle. Why the teachers were the leaders in the social movement and not the small farmers or the rural Oaxacans.
I mean, it could be any other sector.
Cualquier otro sector.
Ah, sí. Sí, no, especialmente.
So the question is interesting because the teachers union in Oaxaca is probably one of the most, the biggest things that organizes people in all of Oaxaca. There are 70,000 teachers within this union, this teachers union. So the weight that the teachers union has, no other organization has this sort of weight. It doesn't even matter. They can't compare with an organization that has 70,000 people. And that's to say that the leader of the teachers union was, in a way, the formal leader of this movement, the social movement in Oaxaca.
Por eso entonces es que la mayoría de.
But so this is why the majority of the movement. This is why the majority of the leadership were teachers. But I want to say that this movement was very innovative. That it was not a movement of leaders as well. So this movement comes from the base. It comes from the base. Like for example, if the leader of the teachers union got on the radio and said, on Monday we're going to go back to classes. The next day there's a huge demonstration of the people saying, no, we're not going back to classes on Monday.
One of the candidates running for president in the United States, Dennis Kucinich, has said that if he became president, he would abrogate NAFTA. He would abolish the NAFTA. Would this be useful?
Bueno, dependiendo, yo.
Depending. I have two different perceptions about this. One comes from a very conservative sector that says, oh, we don't want any sort of any relationship with any other country. And then one that's more liberal, this accord has brought nothing but more poverty to countries like Mexico. I think that a more reasonable position right now might be to renegotiate the agreement.
Establecer otro tipo de condiciones que nos permita.
To be able to establish conditions that would create more equal relationships.
In a state where much of the economy comes from very small groups of people producing, what do you see as the economic solutions?
Si en el caso propio.
So in the case of Oaxaca, before the economic crisis, because of the economic crisis, the Oaxaca people have given two different types of answers to that. One that's an individual answer and one that is a collective answer.
La respuesta individual que ha dado.
So the individual answer to this of the people of Oaxaca has been migration. And this is the individual response. And this is people that decide to migrate to find better conditions or to bring better conditions to their life.
A esta solución en Oaxaca.
And this is known in Oaxaca as the painful relief of the economic crisis. Migration is the painful relief of the economic crisis.
La otra respuesta, la
and the other answer is an answer that is more sustainable and long-term. And this answer is more communitarian and collective.
Un ejemplo de ello.
And one of the examples in Oaxaca that's very interesting are cooperatives made by small farmers, especially in the coffee production, where small farmers have gotten together in a cooperative for both the production and export of coffee.
O pueblos que tienen
or different towns that have a forest around them, and they organize themselves in a collective wood industry where they are then able to export their products of wood products.
O pueblos que se organizan que tienen
towns and communities that organize themselves where they have springs or a water source, and then they organize themselves to be able to bottle water or bottle water to sell.
El problema es que cada vez.
But the problem is that the doors keep shutting. For example, Coca-Cola, they're always trying to buy different land plots where there's water. They want to drill wells and they want to take the water.
But nevertheless,
I think that the answers to this economic crisis are the connections that different small farmers are making to be able to productively use their land or to be able to take advantage of their natural resources.
Just wanted to finish up. On the last note that Miguel left us on, he was talking about weaving together the social fabric that's been damaged and creating links of solidarity. And I mentioned in Winter Peace a couple of ways that we've been doing that. One of the most concrete ways anyone can do that, probably in this case, is to simply go to Oaxaca, which is what we're doing in March. So all of you are welcome to join us. And March 1 through 9, we've got some flyers back there. Our plan is we're going to go down to Oaxaca. We're going to meet with organizations like Educa. Todd will be there as well on the Mexico team. I'll be going on the trip. We'll meet with a lot of the organizations that were at the heart of this popular uprising. You'll be meeting with the teachers. And as Miguel mentioned, the intention is not just to go and say, oh, look at the poor Mexicans, but to go really see what Mexicans are really doing, how they're grouping together, how they're organizing themselves into these cooperatives, how they're trying to seek out solutions. We will also be staying with a host community, an indigenous community, that has seen many of its neighbors, its family, its friends, sent north to the United States as illegal immigrants. You'll have a chance, you'll be eating their food, you'll be sleeping in their beds, you'll be able to talk to them what their lives are like, why they see so many of their friends and family going north, and what it's really meant for their community. Once again, the idea, of course, is that it's not an abstract theory, but that these become pretty concrete realities pretty fast as you're living them. So March 1 through 9, there's flyers back there. Think about it. So come check it out for yourself. Miguel was talking about how, you know, a lot of people are trying. They're trying to get together, trying to resolve this economic situation, but a lot of doors have been shut to them. The largest door that's been shut in recent times has probably been NAFTA. As Miguel was explaining, you know, people simply cannot produce. They cannot compete against Cargill's and Monsanto's in the world. It's ridiculous to think that a campesino producing in Oaxaca or in anywhere in Mexico will be able to achieve that level of production, that level of competition. And so Miguel has often told us that, you know, I don't know if you know, Oaxaca was considered the birthplace of the domestication of corn. Now for Oaxacans to be able to eat corn, they have to import it because of how many people have lost their jobs as corn farmers. The statistic that most organizations have agreed on, most analysts have agreed on, is 1.3 to 1.5 million farmers that lost their jobs under NAFTA in Mexico. 1.3 to 1.5 million. Obviously, one thing that people are pushing for, as Miguel mentioned, is the renegotiation of this existing free trade agreement. But there are a couple others that are coming up, potentially even in this month, the Peru free trade agreement. And then the Colombia Free Trade Agreement, something that's about to hit the floor of Congress, something that can be defeated. We nearly defeated the CAF, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, and most people are assuming that we can defeat these next two. They're based on exactly the same model, the same failed model of NAFTA. In Peru, it's particularly worrisome given migration. If we are really concerned about migration, and we really think this is a problem and this is an issue, we would probably do well not to make it more difficult for Mexicans to live in Mexico, or for Peruvians to live in Peru.